Yes, all these experiences are about stirring up the unconscious material, seeing things within the unconscious and experiencing feelings that you haven't previously been aware of. And of course, some of that content is disturbing. And that's what Jung would call an encounter with the psychological shadow. So the shadow is the unconscious or psyche. It lies between the ego and the higher self. The shadow is everything that is not the ego. So that's very, very big. The higher self is a combination of the ego and the shadow. In everyday life, our allegiance is to the ego. We're fully occupied with practicalities of living, and there's little opportunity, will, or apparent necessity for us to relate to our shadow. Even if we do get the time, there's infinitely more pleasurable things to do than to keep your shadow company. Most of our education and encouragement in life is about working with the visible, tangible aspects of living which exist in the domain of the ego, involving ourselves in what we can know and understand, what feels familiar, helps us to feel grounded and orientates us so that we feel secure and safe. We spend a lot of time focused on becoming useful citizens, performing the work we like or that is necessary, creating family, and finding the community that we fit into. And this is all ego building, essential for us to survive and to thrive. So it's good. But there's a cost. We tend not to focus on complex, abstract, or obscure things. The things that only can be understood when we see them from multiple perspectives, from above, from below, and side on. We want to look, we're built to look and walk forward because that's the lit path that we can see. And it appears to be the fastest route to everywhere we want to be. And the forces at play in the world, the excessive raja, created through every industry, even self-help and spiritual industries, which they are industry, propel us to desire visibility, efficiency, and a kind of perfection. Whether it's house improvement or self-improvement, we're always trying to iron out our perceived flaws. So even in times when the shadow steps right in front of us, as it does regularly throughout the day, through certain thoughts and interactions, through the problems we experience, through moods and feelings, the last thing we want to do is slow down, take our eyes off the clear path forward so that we can arrive at a more complete perspective and understanding of what just happened. To ask ourselves, you know, what really triggered that unpleasant thought or reaction? Why did I get so nasty or jealous or angry or hurt over that little thing? That's shadow eruption. And even if we do get to the point where we have enough awareness and interest to ask those questions, we just don't have the time, mental space, or the real desire to go there. It's not pleasant. And so when we're confronted with our shadow and the shadows that are not our own, which happens, our habitual response is to go into compensation mode, to ameliorate the feelings evoked by the encounter. And we have many well-practiced ways to do that, from simply cutting off emotion, to busying ourselves with tasks, finding something to soothe ourselves, such as food or comforting thoughts. We also have destructive ways. We may react defensively to confrontations with the shadow by protesting, gossiping, blaming, arguing, plotting against, or in some cases by becoming violent. We each have our own cunning and strange way of coping with the daily encounters with the shadow. And we barely notice our own mechanisms because they're also unconscious. And realistically, as I said, we can't be always aware of the shadow all of the time. That's not very healthy. That would make us extremely neurotic. When we meditate and, you know, get to relax and we're alone, and even when we dream, the conscious ego relaxes. Initially in meditation, the gross tensions are released through simple breath awareness, and this evokes feelings of pleasure. For some meditators, the feelings are accompanied by imagery, such as fond memories of people, places, and events or times in their life that were rich with good feelings. However, the tensions run really deep as the shadow. So in meditation, as we go beyond initial relaxation into very deep relaxation, the ego gives over a little more of its power to the unconscious. And as it does, we go deeper and deeper into those, you know, more bound up tensions. Activating the psychic centers naturally exposes unconscious tensions bound up in the shadow. All that the ego has cast aside is there, flaws and failings, archetypes that we never wanted to know about, perhaps a materialist, perhaps a brute, a fool, a snob, an everyman or an everywoman, just an ordinary person who the ego has been striving to blot out in its desire to be special. In meditation, although the ego has let go of its strong hold, it hasn't completely disappeared. Even in dreams, the ego is present and vigilant to all the power plays of shadow factions. One aspect of the shadow finally gets a little light. That is, we get a flash of insight and the ego comes to the rescue. It battles to save us the pain of seeing our darkness, of falling into the abyss of our flaws, failings, the archetypes, the feelings that we don't understand or want. And this battle births very profound tensions, and these can be confusions about our identity, how we value ourselves, and our morality. So in meditation, if the encounter with your shadow is overwhelming, you just, you know, come out of the meditation and return to it later. You slow down, you become more gradual with your meditation, because you always have the option to stop. You are in control, not the shadow. One other important thing to mention is if the encounter with your shadow is extremely destabilizing, it means there's work to do on your ego. A healthy ego is a scaffolding from which we can explore the shadow without feeling devastated or depressed by the encounter. And of course, there's great purpose in getting to know the shadow. It's not all terrible. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, and that is, as it becomes more integrated into your conscious mind, you see the value in the shadow. You see jewels eventually. You see this amazing light in the shadow, and that all enables you to become more whole. That's what the whole purpose is, that you're not just this ego walking around, that you're bigger, you're more complex, you're more mysterious, you know. So that's a wonderful thing. We've already talked about the shadow in class 3 a little bit. So now I want to talk about it more, because I like the shadow. But we spoke about it in class 3, and now specifically we discover that the shadow originates and is most active in the lower chakras, Muladhara and Swadhisthana, because they are the furthest from the light of empathy, communication, intuition, and spirit. Anahat Vishuddhi, Agya, and Sahasra. So my focus today is really on how the shadow makes us feel, when the shadow is too great, that it makes us feel isolated and alienated, which is, as we know, it's a big problem in the world today, this feeling of disconnection. And we feel cut off from ourselves and life, and knowing what we're doing here on the planet, when the lower chakras dominate our existence, the shadow has become so unconscious that it has created an opacity that blocks us from knowing the truth of our existence and real knowledge. We experience immense suffering in the form of ignorance, delusion, and feelings of profound alienation. And they're all qualities of tamas. In the pandemic, physical isolation killed thousands of people and afflicted many more with mental illness. And one of the reasons was that many people did not have the internal resources and resilience that makes extended physical isolation bearable. And of course, I'm not saying that this was the only reason. There were enormous, complex pressures that endangered people's very survival. But the pandemic, whether it's pandemic or no pandemic, when the shadow is unconscious, we become wholly invested in social existence. We tend to believe that the only value in life is to be found out there in the material world and by belonging to mass consciousness. And that's where our energy goes and our vision goes out there. The paradox is that we experience a sense of belonging in being integrated into society, into that consciousness, which is important, but we also feel a sense of a loss of self, which brings this feeling of isolation. And the feeling of isolation can sit under the surface of our awareness for a long time before we fully recognize it. Sometimes that goes on for decades. And the paradox is very unsettling. It kind of gives you an anxiety. We feel that we belong, but it's only to the finite, physical, material world. Living in that level of consciousness makes us feel highly dependent on the external world. So we become fearful, selfish, and overly attached to finite material things. Everything becomes a temporal object. You know, it might vanish, it might disappear if I don't have this grasping attitude. It's all about me, and others are only commodities. Relationships become transactional. Sexuality departs from love. Love and possession become intertwined. Children become objects of parents' ego desires, and friends are reduced to their usefulness, for example, for their status or entertainment value. And this is the disease of narcissism. It comes from the shadow that has taken control. And Jung said something to the effect that the shadow not only consists of weaknesses and defects, but the potential for demonic dynamism, meaning that the freewheeling shadow has the vitality, the firepower to launch evil. It is an enormous power. And it's easy to see it in the world. We can see the narcissism of leaders and corporations, but the potential also exists within every human being. You can spend a long time trying to fill your life with the pleasures and a false sense of security in the form of people, things, and activities, but the sense of isolation, the absence at the core of your being, the chasm between living and knowing why you're living grows. That core absence is obscured by busyness, routines, and habits, but it eventually reveals itself through sleepless nights, wondering what my life's about, disturbing dreams, and in moments you find yourself drifting into these yearnings for a life far from the reality you were living. And this is often the trigger for what is a midlife crisis. They call it midlife crisis, and that actually can occur at any age. That sort of faint, exasperated voice whispers, is this all there is? What usually happens then, when that voice can no longer be buried, is that we pursue the answer, a vision of what life could be. If no answer comes, we can become impatient and frustrated, and this can go on for a long time. We can feel stuck in this never-ending search. And many people, fortunately, interpret this as the need to find purpose and meaning in their lives, and others can fall into anxiety and existential depression. You know, what's the point of living? What is the point of it all? And these people are still stuck in that mass consciousness, focused on the material world and the social world. They can only want what others want because that's all they know and believe is possible. They can brainstorm forever and not come up with what feels worthwhile or enduring because they don't know about that core absence, why it exists. They just know that it's there. Over the years, I've written a few articles on purpose, and they've sort of gone out into different platforms. And so people from different walks of life have contacted me wanting to know their purpose. And what I often discover is that even though they've reached a sense of disillusionment, they still have their sights set solely on that outer world to solve their crisis. So rather than address their purpose, they need a way of reaching into understanding that core emptiness first. It's sort of like, well, who is this person seeking the life purpose? That has to be found first. Otherwise, they're continually looking for different kinds of life purposes and jumping from, you know, what they think might work, and it's still connected to the outer world. Most people are quite relieved to hear that. It makes sense. While others are horrified because they believe that everything can be fixed by a mechanistic approach, which is how they've tried to solve their issues before. They basically want a formula. And here's an example. A very educated, successful man contacted me and he told me that he needs to find his purpose over the next 3 weeks. He was about to be promoted into a leadership role of an international organization that taught personal excellence, and that involved also teaching about purpose. To get the promotion, he was asked to write an article on how he found his purpose and developed personal excellence. However, he didn't know his purpose and he didn't have that sense of personal excellence. Despite all his achievement, he was smart, extremely well read, he knew so much, but it was all academic knowledge, all sort of rational knowledge, which is, you know, the lower chakras. So even academic intelligence does not mean that you have escaped the trappings of mass consciousness. It is so powerful that it lives in all of us. But it's all about the degree that matters. How much sway does it have? How bound am I? How deep does it go? You know, how much is it really inside, like controlling? And these are all the questions that we need to answer. And of course, it also goes for people with spiritual fields. When the shadow is dominant, spiritual achievement is all about gain. What will I get from becoming spiritual? How much more important will I be when I am spiritual? And the man I'm speaking of, he was, you know, had so much going for him that intelligence was quite something, but he was chronically lonely and so protected around that vulnerability, which was, you know, something to behold Really. So to put it very simply, when the shadow dominates, your true identity becomes a mystery to you. You are lost in that mass consciousness. You feel, as they say, alone in the crowd. But we have to solve that paradox, you know, the feeling of being with people and in activities, but feeling alone. And if we asked Carl Jung that question today, he would say something like, you feel alone in a crowd until you have individuated. You feel alone when you have unconsciously bought into the value and ideas and imagining not of your own making, not of your highest potential. And fortunately, you can reduce the degree of mass consciousness, the degree that it has over you, by integrating the immense power of the lower chakras, their vitality, their firepower, the ability to motivate, with the light of the upper chakras. And so that's the part of individuation. And you do this with meditation, but equally you do it through self-reflection, personal psychological insight, through esoteric training, and through everyday living. That's the kind of arena that you have to work in, everyday living. Eventually, that faint, exasperated voice that questions, is that all there is, changes. It says, no, that's not all there is. Life is more than material, and you are eternal. And it can take a long time before you hear the confidence in that voice. But when it comes, you experience this truth and this knowledge of your very existence, and you no longer feel that aloneness. So we'll talk more about individuation in future classes.
Thank you.